From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and we're here every week discussing mental health issues from a more holistic perspective, which means body, mind, and spirit, which means actually developing a consciousness that brings a sense of balance to our lives. Now, speaking of that balance, I'm making a commitment this week and for the next 4 weeks to try and bring a sense of balance to my own life by offering up this hour to the Kerry campaign and the electoral votes of a swing state like Arizona for something that I truly believe in. My listening to many of the more conservative radio shows on the air, I know that politics gets a lot of airtime, and I am a true believer in balance. And so for this week and the next 3 weeks, I'm getting help by Sue Olitsky, who helps with the media campaign for the Kerry campaign in the Arizona area, by helping me get some guests on the show that can speak basically the Democratic point of view and something I believe in so much that I'm actually calling in the show today, this live show, from Clearwater, Florida, where I flew from Los Angeles and spent the weekend to attend the concert last night with the Dixie Chicks and James Taylor, which is one of the concerts for Kerry that has been taking place all around the country the last few weeks. It was quite an evening, an amazing experience. I've seen James Taylor in concert a few times going back to my college years, and really support the Dixie Chicks. Because since the show is about telling the truth faster, Natalie Maines and the Dixie Chicks spoke their truth and are still standing tall and still speaking their own mind despite a lot of criticism, which often comes when people speak their own truth. James Taylor at one point in the concert said, and I'll quote you actually because I wrote it down, in between one of his songs, he says, "People tell me you don't change horses in the middle of the stream. But if your horse doesn't know how to swim and is in way over his head, if you're going to change horses, make it a mule, a big old Democratic mule." And got a standing ovation for that, as did a lot of the comments made by the Dixie Chicks. It was a great concert. I was glad to have made the trip for it, and I am glad that I have the guest that I have today, who I'll be introducing to you in a minute. His name is Stuart Starkey, and he's running for the Senate of the United States against Senator John McCain. Before I get into that, I want to read a couple of paragraphs here, and this is something actually I wrote right after the 2000 election, as I was reminiscing. "In the fall of 1968, I remember being a naive and true American. I remember being a freshman at Harper College, now Binghamton University in New York, and defending my government and my president because I was raised to believe that they would always tell the truth and that the system always worked. We had a right and just purpose to be in Vietnam because we were told this by our government. I remember standing in the dorm lounge arguing with this 6'4" militant sophomore named John and thinking he was crazy to be that agitated and opinionated. This was a time of turmoil in our country. Civil rights, women's rights, students trying to teach our elders as much as learn from our professors, and in 1969 we experienced Stonewall riots. It was a time of activism for many, but for me, always the cautious one, I watched and felt uneasy. I began to feel things that frightened me. But I am grateful to have been a part of history that molded my sense of conscience and taught me what was possible when the cause is just and my heart finally screams out at a volume that I cannot ignore. I try now to listen to my heart even when my voice is quieter. I've learned that my heart is always right and my head understands that it must find a way to follow through on the heart's urging. It took many semesters and the invasion of Cambodia to finally get me to listen to my heart and march and protest and hand out flyers to workers at IBM in Endicott, New York. I marched to Albany for gay rights. I attended rallies. I was angry and scared of my anger and scared for my country. I remember doing this not as a leader, but as a timid man still afraid that I was doing something bad. There was power in these actions that came from within that was unfamiliar to me, but it felt good. That's just a short quote from a longer article I wrote called Election-Related Depression that I wrote after the 2000 election. Why I'm reading that is because if there are some of you out there that are scared for what's going on in our country and in the world and are afraid to speak out because you feel that the direction we're heading in may be wrong, but you really are afraid to buck the system or buck your family or buck your party or buck the city you live in or the state you live in, be willing to take a stand, because that's about empowerment. That's about speaking your own truth, like Natalie Maines did back in London. It's about speaking your own truth and living your own truth and feeling like you're living in a space of integrity. Be willing to question. It took me a long time as a college student when things were crazy around us. But when I finally started to question, when I finally started to take a look and finally started to listen, then maybe some of the people I was disagreeing with might be right. There was a sense of awakening and an empowerment that came that I'm urging some of you who may be swing voters right now to pay attention to. And that's something my guest today, his name is Stuart Starkey, and he is running for the office of senator from the state of Arizona against the current Senator John McCain. Now, John McCain, I'll say up front, for my own opinion, is one of the few Republicans I used to have a lot of respect for, and if faced with a decision to vote for him, he's one of the few Republicans that, as a very staunch and longtime Democrat, I might have voted for until I heard him speak at the Republican National Convention. Now, I'm one of those people that, because I believe in equal time, and thanks to C-SPAN, listen to the Democratic Convention gavel to gavel, thanks to Tebow. And for equal time and for fairness and for my own sense of integrity, I did the same with the Republican Convention. That was a lot of hours. Of course, I passed through the breaks and all that stuff. But it is hard for me to feel comfortable and respect a man who stands up and says, I support the Republican Party and this president and his actions and this platform, when you know from most of what he said, he doesn't agree with most of that Republican platform. And my opinion, and I think the opinion of many others, is he is hoping Bush gets reelected, knowing Cheney's not going to run for presidency, and in 2008 he's trying to position himself for the Republican nomination, and I really believe what he did was sell his soul to the devil, because there are a lot of swing voters that will not respect what he's doing, including this one, who's a staunch Democrat, that would have considered, depending who he was running against. So I'm very pleased that, despite the strength of his incumbency, that someone had the courage and the sense of adventure, you might say, to actually stand up and say, I'm going to run for the U.S. Senate against John McCain. And that's who my guest is today, Stuart Starkey. Stuart, you there?
Hi, sir.
Welcome to the show. I'm really proud and glad to have you on the show today.
It's great to be with you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. I know that you're an eighth grade math teacher on the south side of Phoenix. How long have you been teaching?
Yeah, I've been teaching for 4 years. Before that, I had my own business, but I had also my whole life thought about being a teacher, and finally, one day as I was preparing to go out on one more business trip, my wife had the guts to say, you know, you've always talked about wanting to be a teacher. Why don't you give it a try? And I went down and started as a sub and found out it was what I always should have been doing. And I've been doing it ever since.
Tell me about the students that you teach in the school.
Well, we're on the south side of Phoenix. For those in Arizona, understand that's the poverty area of Phoenix. My population is 88% Hispanic, 12% African American, all Title I, which means they all qualify for the free lunch program because of the income level. It's a tough school in a tough neighborhood, but every year we get a new batch of kids, and, you know, I always come home early on and I say, oh, this is the worst group of kids I've ever had. And, of course, by the time the Christmas break comes, it's always the best group of kids I ever had. And we just learn to respect each other and to challenge each other and to demand the most. And, you know, my job is to teach them the basics of math, but also the basics of life, and to make them believe that they can do great things. And I'm very proud of a lot of the kids that have gone on from me. So
That's great. And I know that you and I kind of come from similar backgrounds, from, you know, somewhere around New York City. How old are you, could I ask?
47.
47. So you're somewhat familiar with the period that I was reading about earlier.
Yeah, it was actually wonderful to listen to. When I was in 11th grade, sort of at the very end of the Vietnam War, one of my professors or teachers gave me a topic for my research paper, and that topic was the Gulf of Tonkin. And the last line I'll never forget when I had to do the oral presentation part of my research project was, "The government lies to you."
Wow.
And he looked at me and he said, "You got it. I gave you this topic for a reason." And who knew that someday maybe it would be that I would be running for the U.S. Senate against, you know, clearly one of the toughest, you know, Senate guys to beat in America. But he knew then, I think, what, you know, I now know, and that is that this is my purpose. And I'm delighted to get a chance to be with you and to talk to, you know, your listeners and explain this race. And why I'm here today in a big way goes right back to, you know, that same time that you were talking about.
Well, talk about what it felt like to be a 11th grader, I think you said?
Yeah.
And to actually stand up in front of a class and say the government lies to you.
Well, you know, it's the same as you being in that hallway with that other fellow that you had talked about. It's some people adamantly, you know, said they never would do that. They never would do that. Or, you know, this president, you know, would never lie and so on and so forth. And you just have to sit there and you have to take the strength of your own conviction and be willing to go up against those who at that time, you know, don't think you have the popular view. And then you look back years later and they all would have said to you, "My gosh, who said, you know, the government lied to us in 11th grade? Who would have known?"
Right.
And it's something you personally don't want to believe. You know, I remember my mom took every one of us from New York to Washington, D.C. as our present for our 12th birthday. And it was a hard thing for her to do. I come from a divorced family and, you know, tough upbringing. But every child, when they were 12, got to go to Washington, D.C. for 2 to 3 days. And, you know, we stood at the Lincoln Memorial and at the Washington Memorial. And, you know, you want to believe in the purity of government. And the words of Lincoln up there, I remember, had an impact on me. And I stuffed envelopes of the kids, the candidates, because it was the thing you did, you know, and you believed in the process. But you never want to believe that your government could lie to you, or that if your government is wrong, they won't admit they were wrong. But even to do it at 16 or 17 years old, to see the reality of it and the confidence of yourself is an important
thing. You just said something. I have to interrupt you. You just said, "I stuffed envelopes when I was 12 for candidates because that's what kids do." That's not what I see kids do, and it's not what I did at 12. How did that come about? I mean, what was your motivation behind that?
Well, you know, it was just in the upbringing that I had my whole life. You know, growing up on Long Island, having been taken, you know, as a kid to Valley Forge and, you know, walking at Lexington and Concord and remembering these things, and just that trip, you know, when I was 12, just, you know, understanding what America meant. My mom, you know, just reinforced in all of her kids, and some of us took it in at different levels. But to me, you know, you got engaged in politics because the rights and the power and the freedom that I had even at 12, and the way that it was for my mom, and the fact that, you know, she'd be making less than a man doing the same job, and why was that, or why were things, you know, better for some schools than others, just had an impact on me early on. The biggest political moment, I was asked the other day by a reporter out here, they said, "What's the biggest political moment of your life?" Expecting it to be about me. It was, you know what, when I was very young, I remember the Robert F. Kennedy funeral.
Right.
And just having those things make an impact, you know, in me, and listening to other people and feeling that average folks could make a difference, that maybe some kid coming from a poor neighborhood in New York, you know, can make a difference, just like other people did before us. It just, it's always been a part of what it was in my family.
So you went out to make a difference. What was the business you were in before you went into teaching?
Well, I worked for various companies for a while in the apparel business. My degree is in accounting and apparel from Philadelphia College of Textile Science. Tells you how long ago. Now it's Philadelphia University, you know,
uh-huh.
Times change. But I worked for other people in other department stores. I worked for Izod. And then one day I said, you know what, I'm going to go out and do this on my own, because I was tired of working for companies that closed American factories and moved all their manufacturing offshore. So I formed my own little business called White Eagle Sportswear, white for purity, the eagle from the American symbol, because all of my goods would be made in America. And for years we went on and sold, you know, promotional merchandise and shirts with logos on it and stuff, until finally even we were overrun by the NAFTAs and the World Trade Organization, which made it impossible to compete with American products in that industry anymore.
Hmm.
And now here I am, a school teacher.
And like you said, I set out to make a difference. Now, making a difference as a school teacher, I'm not saying as a businessman you couldn't have made a difference and probably did make a difference, because you were actually very conscious in the sense, I want these things to be made in America. I want to be able to say, when I sell these things, I'm giving jobs to Americans.
And that's what it was. That's what made me make that move, was to say, you know, wait a minute, we don't have to take the jobs away from our families.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, it's paramount today. And, you know, January 1st, in fact, the last final quotas and tariffs end on Chinese goods, and hundreds of thousands of apparel and textile workers still left in America will lose their jobs next year because the mills will no longer be able to compete. So the world has not changed for the better, no matter how much, you know, we put our line in the sand.
Mm-hmm. So then you decided to make a difference in a more direct way, which is actually getting into the minds of the young people. Eighth graders is a very... I mean, puberty is during that time, and that sense of identity, sense of socializing, is all being developed in that junior high school time period. And here you are in a classroom with this essence that you've been talking about, what you came out of from your parents' inspirational approaches to child rearing, which I actually commend them. And you're standing in front of a group of kids teaching math. What is the reaction you tend to get from them?
Well, you know, we always have the battles we win and the battles we lose. And one of the greatest frustrations when I first started was you tried to win everyone. But slowly you learn, you know, and I remember I had a great partner my first year teaching, and he said, Stu, you can't win them all. He says, you have to learn to take the losses, and you focus on the wins. And it's true, because unfortunately there are just some kids that just won't understand what you're trying to bring them into, especially down in the areas where we teach. So unfortunately, we lose a few. You find out they're in the gangs, or they end up in jail even in the year that they're teaching you. And there's just nothing you can do to win them all. But I'll tell you, when you take someone who maybe just hasn't been enlightened yet, and you see that they accept your challenge to do your work, to learn your way, to focus on doing better at it, and to get that spirit that they can be something in their life, you know, that they never thought they can be, it's just a great moment. And it's individual wins, and you just get more and more of them. And, you know, I'm really proud, you know, just to throw some numbers at you. The year that I was doing seventh grade, before I started in eighth, only 4 students out of 150 of our students passed the high school district's placement test to go into high school at grade level. And this past year we had 50, you know, 2 years later. And we continue to challenge ourselves to do even better than that. But now the philosophy of our eighth grade classroom is, yes, we can do it. We can go out and compete against anybody else, and we can be successful. And that now, you know, we talk to the kids and we say, okay, now you're going to high school. Big deal. What college are you going to go to? And we just change the mindset and the landscape and the mental side of our school, and it's just really fulfilling.
So basically what I'm hearing is a lot of what we do in therapy also is to help people change their perceptions, and by changing their perceptions, they change their reality. And by changing their perceptions about who they are in the world and what's possible for them in the world, it changes their ability to challenge themselves to aim higher.
Right, and we have a sign up in my classroom this year, because last year we had one of the highest achieving eighth grades. We even had somebody from the governor's office in my classroom, so we saw the numbers. What's happening in this room that has to happen in every eighth grade classroom? And I pointed to him, I said, you see that sign up there? It says, the best of the best. That's what this room is all about. When you come in here, you demand of yourself to be the best of the best. And we tell them, these kids have spent their whole lives learning what they can't do And here we teach them what they can do. And it's just, it's a beautiful day.
That's a great philosophy and a great approach that I have other friends that are teachers. And this to the teachers that really make a difference, and I remember back to the teachers that made the most impact on my own lives, were the ones that actually saw each of us as individuals instead of, you know, the class. I mean, I had an English teacher in eighth grade that used to hit kids up the back of the head and do everything he could to humiliate us in English class.
Yeah.
And even as an eighth grader, I kept asking myself, why is he teaching? Why is he here? Is this where he feels? I was, I guess, wiser than most, but what went through my head is this the only way he can feel some sense of power over somebody?
Right.
And that's an eighth grader thinking that about it, the adult who's supposed to be inspiring us and helping us feel safe in a learning environment. And it sounds like that's what you do. You help kids feel safer in a learning environment.
Well, what it is they know that they can take my discipline side and my demanding side, because they also know that the first person, not even just the teacher, but the first person that they know they can always come to is me, no matter what the issue is. And I believe in that, and it's why I'm always down there. And it's, you know what, I tell other teachers this one simple thing, because by no means am I the best teacher. Maybe I'm a different teacher, but I'm not the best teacher. But there's a reason I'm sitting at the soccer games or at the concerts or at whatever, even things not related to school. When those kids feel you connect with them, then you can teach them. And I'm so proud of how many of them who have moved on into high school, but especially like the Hispanic girls who invite me to their quinceañeras a year later or 2 years later when they turn 15. And they're like shocked that I show up. But it's because I tell them, I'm part of your life. That's the key. And when they know that, then real learning can happen.
Well, I want to make you aware of something. It's a half hour into the show so far, and I know, and I said to everybody, and anyone who lives in Phoenix knows that you're running for the U.S. Senate, but we haven't really discussed your candidacy yet or what your intention is.
Well, you know what? If I can interrupt you, in a way, yes, we did, because my candidacy is about what we've talked about.
Exactly.
And I know you have to get into specific issues and you have to bring up the opponent and all those things, but I will tell you the reason that I'm running for the United States Senate. It's the same reason that I go to that classroom every day. And if we can bring this level of commitment to kids and communities and neighborhoods from the U.S. Senate, we can do great things. So that answers, I hope, for your listeners why I'm running for the U.S. Senate. That's the difference between me and my opponent and the average politician, is we want to do the same thing from the point of view of a U.S. senator.
Well, and that was actually the point where I was going, because to me, most people want to know who the candidate is. They want to know what they bring to it. It's just, you know, it's like anything else. If you're doing business with someone, you want to have a sense of why they do what they do and why their service or their product's going to be worth your time and attention and purchasing, things like that. And to me, getting to know who you are and what motivates you and the changes that you made in your life and the decisions that that you made and the integrity behind those decisions, the sacrifices that were entailed in those decisions, going from a business environment to a school salary, for one thing, couldn't have been an easy thing to do. But there's a sense of commitment, and there has to be some inspiration the kids are getting out of seeing their teacher do this, knowing it's like you and I talked earlier, it's like a David and Goliath type of thing. I mean, John McCain has the name, he has the incumbency, he has a track record, he has, you know, his being a veteran, all this other stuff. I mean, you're up against Goliath. So why are you doing this?
Yeah, and you know what, I just want to, we'll take the David and Goliath thing for a second, and that is because when the NBA playoffs started, everybody congratulated the Lakers. They had Shaquille O'Neal, they had Kobe Bryant, they had the history of being the Lakers.
Right.
What they forgot to do was look at the other team.
Right.
Who may have been younger and may have had less experience and may not have been making the salaries and been on the covers of magazines, but they wanted to win.
They had the heart.
That's right. And they went out and everybody forgot to look at that side. And that's one of the things I tell people is that, you know, you got to understand something. Sometimes when you're only looking at Goliath, nobody realizes that David over there is ready to go. And in this campaign, although we don't have the funding and we clearly don't have the name recognition, you know what? That's okay. Yesterday, I was up in a little town in eastern Arizona called Safford, and I walked the streets before the parade started and shook hands until I couldn't separate my fingers anymore. He wasn't there. And I have been doing that nonstop for the last, 75 to 90 days, I guess it is already, and going around and just explaining to people, you know what, I want this job, and here's why I want this job. And sometimes, while incumbents are out on national television and flying at their level, they seem to forget what got them to that level.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm never going to forget the kids that are in my classroom and what will get me to be a U.S. senator. But you can't outwork me. You can't outwant it more than I do. And so don't be too surprised if, once again, Goliath goes down.
Well, how are your kids? I mean, I'm assuming you're on leave this
Well, we're on vacation this past week and this next week because we're a year-round school. So that helps me with being able to be out campaigning.
But you're actually teaching this tonight.
I do teach. I have not missed a class. You know, I won't do that. My first commitment until Election Day is to my students. So after school is over, I'll Zoom somewhere and make a, you know, one or two appearances a night. And, of course, my weekends are booked. But I don't miss class with my kids. They're disappointed I don't. They're all like, you know, maybe if Mr. Starkey went out campaigning, we wouldn't have to do our homework. But they know I'm going to be there. So they know the homework's got to be done.
What questions and comments do you get from the kids knowing that you're running for the U.S. Senate?
You know what? They've really been enlightened by it because one day we had a reporter from a newspaper come to the school, you know, and get permission to come into the classroom and take some photos and stuff. And it's amazing for the kids because, again, it's not the kind of neighborhood where you're used to that. You know, if you go up into our Scottsdales or Paradise Valley, to them it's no big deal. Mm-hmm. Down by me, the parents don't even vote, you know, where I teach. So we're working very hard to even educate them, not about my campaign, but over the years. You got to vote and you got to be in the process to make a difference, you know, even at the local level. But there's just not that kind of stuff. So now all of a sudden you see this guy who's running for the United States Senate, which in their mind is so far and above. And to them, you know, I just sit there and eat lunch with them. And they can't really reconcile the two. Why is it that you do that, you know? But they're real enthusiastic about it. And, you know, I think some of them are wishing me to win so that they get an easier teacher, you know, to replace me. But a lot of them understand I'm doing it so that they can have it better in America. And they enjoy it and they're excited about it. And when they see the signs out on the streets or something, you know, it really helps motivate them. And it just tells them, hey, I grew up the same way you did, guys, but look where I'm going. You know, and you can do the same thing.
Before I start asking questions about what you would like to accomplish once you're in the Senate, I want to remind our listeners that this is a live call-in show. In fact, I realized I forgot to do this at the top of the show, but I know the lead-in gives it to you. But if you want to ask Stuart Starkey a question or make some comments about what we're talking about today, the number in the Phoenix area is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. And if you are one of those listeners who are tuning in over the Internet on our simulcast, it is still a toll number for you if you're calling from outside the Phoenix area, 480-949-1310. Now, Stuart, getting back to what are your dreams? You know, when you see yourself sitting in the Senate in Washington, what do you want to accomplish once you get there?
Well, there's two different ways to look at it. The most exciting to me, though, would be to have President Kerry have a Democratic majority in the Senate.
Yeah.
And that's what really started this whole thing off, with having a chance to meet him back during the Arizona primaries and figuring I was going to help him. At that point, I didn't know it would be this way. But to be able to get a majority of the Democrats, that would give us control of the committees and let new bills come to the floor that right now Republican committees block.
Right.
So the first thing I want to be able to do is stand there, get sworn in, and as part of the majority, you know, that will totally change the atmosphere with how my agenda, you know, can move forward within the Senate. So that would be real exciting just by itself.
Right.
I've offered and asked to be on the Natural Resource Committee in the Senate, and the reason I did that, of course, as anybody in Arizona knows, we have a water crisis going on right now, and I'm hoping to be able to address that issue, as well as we have, you know, a tremendous issue on a daily basis about trust lands and about, you know, the right uses of lands here. So I think it would really be a benefit to the people of Arizona to have me on that committee. So although it's not the glamour committee and it's not the big money committee, I think it can make a direct impact on the future for us, especially on the water issue. So I hope
to be there. May not be glamour, but it's certainly relevant to the people that you're representing in terms of Arizona, and in particular the whole Southwest.
Exactly, and that's why
they're going on in California and New Mexico, Nevada, everywhere.
Yeah, and that's why I've asked, you know, that I would be able to be on that committee when I get elected. Other than that, of course, paramount is many of the things that I just see every day in my life. We need to work on a universal health insurance program. We need to make sure that every one of our children can have preventive care, something that Mrs. Carey speaks about eloquently, that why are we waiting until our children are sick before they go to an emergency room, the most expensive care that can be received?
Mm-hmm.
What we need to do is we need to work on preventive care, and we need to keep these kids healthy, and we need to have a cost-effective way for every American to see a doctor. And not only our kids, but why are, you know, Arizona seniors end up in Mexican jails, you know, when they're out trying to buy prescription drugs that are affordable. I watched that second presidential debate. The difference on health care is clear between the two candidates. I want to be able to work on that issue as well as a senator.
Very important. I mean, I know while I'm in Clearwater, actually, my mom, who's 81, and her boyfriend, who's 87, flew over here so they could spend the day with me, and we're visiting a friend of my mom's whose family I grew up with in Queens, who's 89, and I was talking to Eleanor, my mom's friend, about the show and that you were going to be on it and stuff, and she was so angry about the so-called prescription drug card that she says it's useless. You know, here she is, 89 years old. She says it's basically a useless thing. She doesn't understand how the president's touting it as something great.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that that's the opinion of a lot of the other seniors here in Florida where I'm visiting, because, to be honest with you, I'm very encouraged because I see carry signs in yards all over the place here.
Right. Well, I will tell you, in Arizona, for instance, more Arizonans have signed up for the Arizona card under Governor Napolitano than have signed up for the card that the federal government is issuing. So when you give, you know, people of Arizona a choice, they recognize that the card that, you know, the Bush administration has put forward and the gaps in between where coverage happens really doesn't help, you know, America's seniors.
Right. Now, I have an opportunity, knowing you're a school teacher, to ask a question that has really been on my mind, and to be honest with you, I just haven't had the right person to ask. There's a lot of talk about this No Child Left Behind program for education in this country. John Kerry says it's been underfunded and really not made a difference, and Bush is saying that, you know, it's the best thing since sliced bread.
Right.
As a teacher, what's your catch on it? How has it affected your job and the schools as you see it in a positive way? Because I believe in, if it's doing well, I believe in giving it credit, but I really want to know.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm going to answer it strictly as a teacher. No politics at all.
Okay.
And here is the single biggest impact that we've had because of No Child Left Behind. Our school for the last 4 years has had a school resource officer from the police department and a probation officer on the campus. And that probation officer has gone into every single classroom on a daily basis, and he talks to kids about staying out of gangs and drug prevention and don't smoke and why you need to do your homework and all those kind of things. That funding is not renewed in the next Bush budget. That man has made a difference in cutting down the assault rate on our campus by over 80%. We now have a safe environment on our campus that we've had for the last 4 years because of funding for that program that was under the Clinton administration.
Uh-huh.
The Bush administration
was instituted under Clinton.
It started under Clinton, yeah. He's been working under a grant program started back when Clinton was president.
Mm-hmm.
The Bush administration removed that funding. Now, next year, that guy is gone, and I can tell you that will have a major impact on the behavior in our classroom, which makes it harder for the kids to learn. It will have a major impact on the parents as to whether or not their kids are going to school in a safe learning environment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been removed by the Bush administration. And the Republican members of the House of Representatives here who vote against it, I say, hey, how can you possibly go to a parent and tell them that you've removed that funding? And they go, Stu, it's such a small percentage of the budget. And I go, yeah, but it's such a big percentage of our everyday life. And we're losing those guys. So right there, before you even get to the ideas of testing and accountability, it tells you right away where the requirements and where the focus point is for the Bush administration. And it's got to help kids. There are specifics about No Child Left Behind, but nothing else should be paramount other than the environment and safety of our campuses. They didn't have the money to fund that any longer.
Okay, Stuart, my engineer just tells me that we have a caller. Are you on the line there?
Yes.
Bob, are you there?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes. Where are you calling from?
Yes, I'm calling from Mesa.
Listen, well, welcome to the show. What's on your mind today?
Well, I've been listening to you guys for the last 35 minutes or so, and I've known this man personally for only 15 months. Stu, do you know who I am?
Well, I'm not sure which Bob.
Okay. This is your boss.
Bob, how are you?
I'm fine. Let me tell you, this man is articulate, he's bright, high energy level, he's earnest, he loves kids, and I couldn't see a better man for U.S. Senate than Stu Starkey. This is Bob.
He's my principal.
Did you know he was going to be on the show today?
I guess my wife just was upstairs, and she said, I think you want to turn on his channel. I think your teacher is on.
Oh, great.
I want to tell you, Stu is very earnest. He's he really is a bright man, and he cares about this country. He cares about... I think he's more like 57 than 47 because he sounds like he lived through the 60s like I did, but he got the best taste of the 60s. He's a wonderful teacher out of all of the schools in our district. His kids got the highest test scores last year in math, but he does it with kindness, kicking a butt when a kid needs one, does it with love, and he does it with tenderness and firmness at the same time.
Wow.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Listen, you have a great day on the campaign trail.
You bet.
Bob, thanks for calling in. I really appreciate it. Listen in again.
Bye-bye.
Well, how's that for a
that's
testimonial?
That's one of those beautiful moments. Trust me, it wasn't solicited.
I know. That's why I asked it. Did he know you were going to be on? Because you know, the synchronicity of things like that, I think, are important to acknowledge.
Yeah.
And to me, everything he says are the qualities that a U.S. senator should have. You know, everything he said about you, about a teacher in the classroom, to me, would be essential integrity issues and behavioral issues for a U.S. senator.
Okay, I'm very grateful for his call.
That's amazing.
Let me bring up one more thing, if I can, about No Child Left Behind.
Yeah, I want to, because you were getting into
in a very specific way, what's wrong with the whole testing technique of No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind tests an individual pool of students. It doesn't track progress of a student in order to be able to help a child. What it does is it takes, let's say, the year 2003 eighth graders, and then they test them and we get a score, and then those children move on. And then we get a new pool of students the following year and we get test scores. And they decide whether or not our school is good or making progress or performing based on the new pool of scores. If No Child Left Behind really cared about having a positive influence on students, then what it should do is it should track a student. And it doesn't do that. So that, for instance, if let's say that one of our best schools anywhere in Arizona, Scottsdale, Paradise Valley, with all the resources, all the libraries, all the swimming pools, okay, if they have great scores, 99% of their kids have passed the test this past year. If the next year they get 12 new students, say, coming over from Sudan, refugees, and they go into this beautiful school, and they don't know any English, but they sit down on the day to take the test, and four of those 12 don't pass, all of a sudden, that school is no longer performing as well because it measured a whole new group in a whole different situation. So until No Child Left Behind starts tracking a child when they're in kindergarten or first or second grade, and it looks to see whether or not that child is learning and what steps you took, let's say, in fourth grade if that child fell behind, did you provide tutoring resources or after-school things for that student? Did you make an accommodation to be able to help that student? That's when the concept of No Child Left Behind can truly work. The way that it's set up now is, I believe, done in order to be able to label teachers and schools as failures.
Wow. You know, I saw a documentary recently on IQ, and basically it was about IQ testing over the years, how it got implemented, why it got implemented, it was a two-part series, I think, on the educational system in the U.S., actually. And then when they got to the issue of why IQ tests got implemented and why they were not healthy and good and the negative impact they actually had was the fact that the same test was given to students everywhere in spite of the language differences and everything else and the cultural differences and how they would read a question differently based on that. And so it's why a lot of minority kids were deemed backward and tracked into you know, business and technical stuff instead of being considered for academic tracks and things like that, what you're saying is the same thing's still going on.
Let me give you a great example of that. Last year, our fifth graders took their Ames test, Arizona's, you know, instruments for measuring. And there was one question on there in the math section, and it said that you were able to get so many cups of juice from a juice dispenser at X number of ounces and so on and so forth. It wasn't that the kids couldn't figure out the ounces, but they were all wondering, what's a juice dispenser?
Mm-hmm.
They're just not used to the terminology and the phrases.
Right.
So what happens is they were already starting at a handicap because now while the other kid is saying, oh, yeah, the, you know, the kids in Scottsdale saying, oh, yeah, that thing on my counter, you know, where we get our fresh squeezed orange juice, whereas the other kid down in South Phoenix is wondering what the heck is a juice dispenser.
Right.
So there's a lot of changes still to be made and a lot of decisions to be made about education.
But you would think that after the whole fiasco with IQ tests in the 40s and 50s and 60s and how clearly they've been deemed to have been culturally unsound and unfair, that stuff that's going on today, you'd think that would be the first thing that people developing these tests would be asking themselves, wouldn't you?
No, we still do it the exact same way. And a kid who's only been here a year and is still struggling to learn the English language is then given a test in English and told to pass it, and when he doesn't, now he's labeled a failure. Well, how much enthusiasm is he going to have for learning going forward if you just labeled the kid a failure?
Wow.
Even though he might have been an A student in Mexico or China or wherever he might have come from.
Mm-hmm.
What I'd like to do, though, if we can, you know, if we have it into the last few minutes, is I'd like to shift even a little bit about my race and why I'm in this. And to be honest with you, I'm in this. I want to win this race. And I'm doing all that I possibly can do to defeat Senator McCain. But we have the biggest presidential election, as you were talking about at the very beginning of this show. And I really, you know, want to take sure and make sure that all your listeners understand the focus. It's great that we win the Senate. It's great that I go to the Senate. But this truly, as far as education and health care and the other issues that are so vital in this country, I hope the debates and the policies and the, you know, just the way that the people are out there presenting themselves and the key issues in America right now, that they understand the huge impact that every vote can have in this presidential election.
Mm-hmm. I think, especially with what went on in Florida, I mean, there's an energy here in Florida that people are still reacting from 4 years ago, so I'm hoping that's really going to make a difference. I think the fact that so many millions have registered for the first time, and the fact that from what I'm hearing and reading, the majority of the new registrations for voters seems to be leaning towards the Democrats, especially in the swing states, I think bodes well, hopefully, for Kerry in Florida, Ohio, and Arizona and some of those places. And I've been hearing that Arizona, because you have had such an influx of people moving to Arizona from the Northeast and from California and stuff, that it may not be as solidly Republican as it used to be.
Let me give you some ideas of what it is, because trust me, I am out there every afternoon and every night and every weekend day. In for instance, Yavapai County, which has traditionally gone to the Republicans here by 30 to 40 percentile in every election, this is the first election where Democrat requests for early ballots have exceeded Republican. The effort of the Kerry team out here has just been phenomenal. The emotions from 2000 are still, you know, very strong here as well. Mm-hmm. And as much as national polls may show us 6 points down or 7 points down or so on and so forth, I can tell you that they don't have any way of recording the intensity and the incredible turnout that's going to happen here in Arizona. I said 3 to 4 weeks ago, maybe a little more than that, to the folks who are running the Kerry campaign here, we'll win Arizona by 10 as long as we maintain the kind of enthusiasm and intensity level that we're seeing. And I've only seen it get bigger and stronger. Whenever I go into any county, the volunteers, the enthusiasm, the first-time voters, the folks who say, you know what, I'm registered with the Republicans, but in this one I want to help, you know, Kerry beat Bush, it's just overwhelming. And I think you're going to see an incredible, incredible turnout by the Democrats and the independents who recognize that in this election there's a clear choice for America.
Well, I'm praying for that, and it's a feeling I'm beginning to get too, and it took that first debate to actually really get me out of some doldrums about this. It was the first time that Kerry got to show himself as clear, presidential, intelligent. That was the other thing that James Taylor said at the conference. At the concert last night, when he was saying, he said, an independent came up to him and said, you know, how, you know, how would you help me decide, you know, which candidate to vote for president? And James Taylor said, well, you listen to the debates, you read what you can about both candidates, you study the issues, and then you vote for the smart one.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, the first debate after a lull that had happened between our convention, there seemed to be a little bit of a quiet period for the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm.
And people were starting to wonder, you know, when are we going to fire it back up? That first debate really lit it up.
Right.
But I tell you, there was one moment in the vice presidential debate, which when I go around and I travel, people seem to bring up this one moment where it seemed to really show the difference between the two campaigns. And it was when Vice President Cheney, with as much conviction as he possibly could, said, even what I know now, I would definitely do the same thing all over again. And if you'll have to forgive my dog, somebody just rang the bell.
Okay.
But it was just an unbelievable moment when he said and made that commitment that he would do it all over again.
Mm-hmm.
And the people had such a clear idea. Wait a minute. We now know things that we didn't know then.
Right.
Even if we're going to accept that you made decisions based on what we knew then. But now they're saying, no, that's just not right. And we wouldn't do the same thing. And I see a lot of momentum just off of that one moment in that debate as well. The other night, you know, the two candidates were pretty close. They put out their positions. Again, I think our guy just looks ready to lead this country, and
right.
I'm very excited about that. But it's that one moment where Vice President Cheney said he would do the same thing all over again that America really has to think about before they go vote.
Well, I think that George OneNote idea that I have, you know, it's like the whole issue of being so rigidly confined to a direction, to me, the mark of a good leader is someone who is willing to be flexible and change their mind when they have reason to change their mind. And, you know, both Cheney and Bush are both saying, this is what we decided, and this is the only way to go, and this is what you should continue to, and you should be afraid if you don't. I mean, they're basically running on a fear tactic and nothing else, and Bush couldn't even fill 2 minutes with an answer half the time. Even with some of the 90-second answers, he couldn't fill 90 seconds.
Yeah, no, and I think the debates are clearly showing a different quality between the president and between Senator Kerry, and I'm totally committed that when somebody right now who's not sure which way they're going watches these debates and sees, you know, who do they feel comfortable with leading this country, to me, the choice is clear. It's been clear for a while. It's great on my part to be able to be a part of this campaign to help, you know, deliver their message and to make it an understanding that we can really, what I call in my campaign, renew the promise, you know, that we can take our country back, you know, from these ideologues who refuse. You know, to not only look at last night where he couldn't recognize any mistake that he made.
I know.
You know, and just something like
well,
that.
Well, not couldn't. He wouldn't.
He wouldn't. You know, and wouldn't. And we live this life every day. We go into our classrooms or whatever our jobs are, and we know that sometimes we're wrong. And sometimes I have to look at students, and believe me, it's not tough. It's tough telling a 13-year-old, oops, I was wrong. Because mm-hmm. they'll never let you forget it.
Right.
But in all different kinds of things, and when we talk about this war, we have to have the courage to look at the parents. You know, we have to be able to tell them, you know what, look, maybe we worked on stuff that was what we thought was right at that time. I don't even believe it was right at that time.
Right.
I think they had information which told them there's no reason to go to war, and they did it anyway. He did this for personal reasons.
Right.
But we need to be able to take a look and change. And that's part of my campaign, quite honestly, against Senator McCain, is how can he stand up there now, knowing what we now know, and say he wants 40,000 more of our kids to go to Iraq for the next 10 years.
Right.
You know, those are my students who will be filling those boots. They love it. They call them boots on the ground.
Right.
As if that's just boots and that's not kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to have, you know what, okay, we were wrong. Let's now say we were wrong. Okay, we don't have to apologize if they thought it was right. Okay, but we have to be able to say to the world right now, we want to work for peace. America stands for peace.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want 10 more years of this.
Right. And that gets us back to even the quote about my experience in college with the Vietnam War and all that stuff, because a lot of people believed we were there for the right reasons, and I totally believe that there were a lot of government representatives who really believed initially we were in there for the right reasons, and we got bogged down there, and nobody was willing to say, you know what, maybe this is a mistake, and let's do something about it. Look what it took to finally get us out of there. Instead of you know, doing it before thousands more died, and I fear that Iraq's going to happen there too. I mean, there's over 1,000 already dead Americans and countless Iraqis who have died. And while I do believe that many of the Iraqis are glad not to have Hussein in there, it wasn't the right way, and it wasn't our fight, and because of what we know now.
Right, and what we're seeing now is the greatest political movement by the people since the movement that ended the Vietnam War, and people can do that again, and that's
yeah.
why I tell them, you know what, a vote for me is a vote to try to get our guys out of there and to end this conflict, and a vote for my opponent is a commitment of 40,000 more soldiers for 10 more years, and it's not only relevant on my level, but it's about going to the U.S. Senate. Somebody said, what are you going to do first? I said, I'm going to raise my right hand. I'm going to get sworn in, and then I'm going to say, President Kerry, let's sit down and figure out how we're going to end this war. And that's what we need to do. We need to have all of America once again rise up and say this is wrong. And the first place that they can show it is November 2nd at the polls.
I totally support that. To me, I there's a phrase that I use. You know, Reagan was to me, partially to credit for the end of the Cold War, but I think he gets too much of the credit for that. If my listeners want to hear more of what I have to say about that, go to my archives on TellTheTruthFaster.com and listen to the show that I did a few months ago called People Are Saying Goodbye to Reagan, I'm Saying Good Riddance.
Yeah, but you know what? I would have no problem right now looking at anybody in this country saying, you know what, Ronald Reagan ended the Cold War, and I will give him all the credit if they will accept one thing. He took on the greatest enemy of his time and defeated them without firing a shot or losing an American life. Are you telling me this president couldn't take down Saddam Hussein the same way?
And the other part to where I was going with that is I really believe, and it's a phrase I think I coined, I believe there's a domestic Cold War going on in this country. And I believe that there are sides drawn, and people are fighting it with each other with words, with legislation that they're trying to get through, and with judgment and anger and rage that acts out into behaviors. But there's a domestic Cold War that we're experiencing in this country unlike any I think we've ever experienced before. And I think, and I would pray that when you go to Washington as a senator from Arizona, that you know, the work that you do is to help do that healing, to help heal this domestic Cold War that's going on.
Well, so, I think that has to be part of our challenge.
Yes.
And I will tell you, I once had, just a quick story, I had a parent come in who was very unhappy with their child's grade. And quite honestly, the parent accused me of being a racist.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the parent and I said, I don't know what color your child is. And of course, I knew that he was an African American. But it didn't impact me in the way I live my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care who walks into my office as a senator, what their color is, what their sexual orientation is, what their political party is.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go forward and we're going to work together to work on the important issues of our time.
Right.
And I hope that we have the kind of political atmosphere that lets that begin to take place.
Now, if people want to reach you, Stuart, how can they? If they want to make donations, if they want to help you with their campaign, do you have a website, or how do they reach you?
Yeah, we do. It's StarkeyForSenate.com. Starkey is spelled S-T-A-R-K-Y, and then it's the word for, not the number for. So it's StarkeyForSenate.com. And on there is where I stand on over 20 issues. One thing we always hear is politicians never tell you where they stand for anything until after they're already in. Everything's on there, where I stand on everything from the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, equal rights, gay rights, right to bear arms. Everything is on there, where I stand on Iraq, where I stand on economics, where I stand on the environment. Everything is on there. And we get a lot of feedback, and I answer emails over 100 a day now from people who ask me a question related to something that's on there. It's a very good site, and I'm really proud of it because it is so informative. They can make a contribution also on there if they want to. This is a campaign, unlike, you know, my opponent who starts off with $3 or $4 million and takes $2,000 from any, you know, person who wants to contribute. I have a personal limitation of $100.
Uh-huh.
Because I felt that if true campaign finance reform was going to happen in any way, again, it starts with people. So I pledged right at the beginning, and it's one of the things that hurt me at the national level. It's, no, you have to take all the money. And I said, no, I'm not taking all the money. I said, well, we've made it on 10s and 20s, so we would be excited for anybody to go there, and they can push the button right away and give a $10 or $20 contribution. We would be honored to take it.
Well, you're doing
so it's
it
good.
Like, go ahead.
So it's just a, you know, another way that we think already our campaign has made a difference. You know, Arizona is one of the few states with this clean elections. And it was our way of saying, you know what, it doesn't have to be that at the federal level, $1 million and 527s and campaign finance reform has to rule the world. So one of the biggest errors of our time is Senator McCain and Senator Feingold's campaign finance reform legislation, because it created the split vote Veterans for Truth and all of these organizations. So what we want to do is we want to let people know we have a limitation of $100, and that keeps gas in the car, and it keeps printed paper for us to hand out and let people know about our campaign.
Great. Stuart, I really want to thank you for being on the show today. I wish you a lot of luck with the campaign. When I get back to L.A., I will be making a contribution to your campaign.
I appreciate it. I hope you have a great time out there, and I want to thank you and your listeners for the hour. Let's get out there and get ourselves a new president, a new Senate, and let's take back America.
All right. Thank you, and lots of luck, and everybody get out there and do your job for Kerry. And I want to thank all of you for listening to Tell the Truth Faster. Tune in next week, and I'll surprise you with my next guest to support this cause. Thank you, and have a great weekend.